Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. We ended last week's episode with a Canadian theme, and we're starting this week's with a Canadian theme, as this past Tuesday, James Paxton of the Mariners threw a no-hitter against the Blue Jays in Toronto. Paxton, a native of British Columbia, became the first Canadian to throw a no-hitter in Canada, and just the second ever Canadian to throw a Major League no-hitter, the other being Dick Fowler in 1945. Paxton's no-hitter was also a Maddox, meaning a complete game shutout, with fewer than 100 pitches thrown, just the 15th in MLB history. He struck out 7 and walked 3. So let's turn to our resident Canadian, Mary. What are your thoughts on Paxton's feat?
I loved it as a Canadian who is not a fan of the Blue Jays, and in fact a fan of a rival of the Blue Jays. It was pretty incredible. I loved that it was such a Canadian moment in that, you know, the team just got no hits, and yet this guy gets thunderous applause from everybody still left in the stadium because he's Canadian and because he pointed to his real ugly maple leaf tattoo on his arm. I love that. I love Paxton. I love that his nickname is Big Maple. That might be my favorite nickname in baseball. And another thing that just adds to the incredible moment that this was is that he was drafted by Toronto in 2009, but the negotiations didn't pan out, and the Blue Jays called Boris Paxton's agent during these negotiations, and then the NCAA ruled him as ineligible for the following season because collegiate players are only allowed to have advisors, not agents. So he ended up having to leave University of Kentucky for his final year and join an independent league team before he was drafted by the Mariners in 2010. So I'm pretty sure that, like, nobody involved really remembers that or, thought about that in the moment. But I think that's just kind of another little bit of sweetness added on to it.
Man, that must have been really meaningful for him. I mean, yeah. That's like, you know, it would have been enough if it had been like, yeah, I'm the first Canadian ever to throw a no-hitter in Canada. But no, it's like there's also this like revenge story involved as well. That must have just been like the absolute peak of his life. I mean, maybe if he got married or something, like I'm sure that was nice too. But like,
no, it's this. It's definitely this.
It's this. Yeah. Yeah. And has there ever been any other situation where someone has gone and thrown a no-hitter in an opposing ballpark and received a standing ovation after like that? Because, yeah, I think typically fans are just like, I'm bitter. I'm going to react to this negatively, or I'll just like be quiet or whatever. Like, I mean, offhand, I can't think of any situation where it would be like so well-received. Maybe it was like a beloved former player who, you know, didn't leave on bad terms and just like came back and people still respected him. Like, but I've never heard of something like that happening before. It's possible It has, but I'm not aware of it.
I'm not aware of it either. And I think that it's just such a stereotypical Canadian thing to have happen. We take a lot of pride in Canadian athletes that don't play in the NHL because they're so rare in the other sports, whereas in the NHL it's just like, oh, a Canadian did something impressive against my team, now I hate them because there's just so many Canadians. So it's really something that's super common to Canadians, but also combined with such a very rare feat.
Yeah, definitely. And I think like that level of pettiness, it just kind of adds to the fact that baseball as a whole can be an extremely petty sport. So to see Paxton throw a no-hitter against a team where he had fallen out of negotiations with and then ruled ineligible just adds to how extremely baseball it is. This season, we've had no-hitters thrown in the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. We've also had a combined no-hitter and a Maddox no-hitter. both nearly equally rare, but which is more exciting?
I'm going with the Maddux, I think. You know, the combined no-hitter is obviously a really cool and unusual thing. You know, we kind of talked about this. It's just last week. Time just goes by so quickly. I don't even know. I don't even understand the passage of time anymore. But nonetheless, yes, it was last week. You know, we kind of talked about how, you know, the differences in the sort of levels of anxiety you experience with like a one-person no-hitter versus a combined no-hitter. And it's like, okay, well, anything extra that we get now after the starter's great performance heading into the bullpen, that's just kind of gravy. Whereas I think with the Maddux, it's like, oh man, is he gonna get it in under 100 pitches? Is he gonna do it? You know, like that's something that I have during just regular non-no-hitter shutouts. So you add that to a no-hitter, and for me, that makes it more exciting. I mean, I understand that it's not something that maybe all baseball fans are paying attention to or care about, but for me personally, I think the Maddux no-hitter is kind of a greater display of dominance.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it just carries more meaning with being named after a player, whereas a combined no-hitter, there's no you know, singular thing that you can point to and say this is the origin of it, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that a Maddux no-hitter just kind of fits baseball better. It's more evocative of what baseball is and how we like to view and write about baseball. So I think that it's more exciting to watch, and I think it's also a better story.
Yeah, I also agree with the Maddux. If I'm going back to my amusement park analogy.
Please do.
The way I see it is like Splash Mountain. Stay with me here. So like I mentioned before, like the roller coaster of a no hitter in itself. But then with the Maddux, you get this extra added, you know, anxiety of whether or not a pitcher is going to be able to keep it under 100 pitches. So it's like when you're going on Splash Mountain and like you know the big drop is coming, but you don't know when it's going to happen, and you don't know if it's going to happen because it's like you have those false starts of like the drops and you think like, oh, this is the big drop, right? No, it's not. And then you keep just getting higher and higher, and then when it happens, it's like full of adrenaline.
I think what I've gotten from all of this is that I really wish there was just a baseball themed amusement park.
Speaking of that,
yes.
In grade 8, we had to, as an exercise for one of our classes, come up with businesses, business ideas, and kind of like make business plans and so on and so forth. And my friend and I partnered for it, and we made a baseball themed amusement park. So
that. Yeah,
there's a plan out there.
Why am I like not surprised to hear that?
So if anyone's listening out there, we need a baseball themed amusement park with a no-hitter roller coaster.
You can pay me for the rights.
Moving away from no-hitters and amusement parks, this wasn't the only Blue Jays news to come out of Tuesday, and unfortunately the other big item is much graver consequence. Toronto closer Roberto Osuna was arrested this week and charged with assault on a woman who, as we later found out, was his girlfriend. Osuna was placed on administrative leave by MLB, meaning he will not play for at least a week. The details beyond that remain sparse at this point. As such, we won't be discussing this subject further since we have already repeatedly expressed our thoughts on domestic violence in baseball in the past. However, it is something we wanted to note that we will be keeping our eyes on. Now, moving on to a lighter subject, Cody Bellinger of the Dodgers appeared on Jimmy Kimmel this past week, and in addition to revealing that he eats banana Nutella crepes at IHOP nearly every day, he also shared that one of his Dodger teammates didn't know that the team had thrown a combined no-hitter until they got into the locker room. Bellinger would not say who it was, so naturally we're going to take some guesses. Which Dodger do we think wasn't aware that their team had just thrown a combined no-hitter?
It's got to be somebody who wasn't in the dugout, because anyone who was in the dugout was aware. You know, they all came out onto the field afterwards and they were like, yeah, this is so great. So it's got to be someone who either they were out of the game entirely or they were never in it. I need to, as we know, I missed this game, so I need to, I should check the actual box score. So give me a sec so I can speculate with a bit more knowledge.
Yeah, that's probably a good guess. Although it'd be kind of funny if it was somebody who was kind of like involved in the entire game and then everybody was celebrating on the field and he had no idea what was going on and just kind of like went with it to not seem out of place. Like, you know, if it was like Cody Bellinger himself and he's just trying to like throw everybody off the scent so that they don't guess that it's him.
There's an idea.
I'm actually wondering if it might have been one of the pitchers. Like, what if it was Walker Buehler, who had no idea?
It wasn't Walker Buehler. He was running out on the field. he knew.
All right. Other than that, I was also thinking, I feel like it definitely would not be Chase Utley. That much, I feel like.
Yeah.
I could kind of see it being Chase Utley. Like, I could see him, like, being so nonchalant, like, oh, what? We threw a no-hitter? Like, oh, okay. Like,
that is, yeah, a good point.
I could actually see that.
But I also feel like as team dad, he would be very aware of everything that's going on.
That's true. These are his children. He's aware of their achievements, you would think.
So, like, I could see it going both ways there.
Right. Okay, looking at this here box score, Austin Barnes got into the game, or he started the game, but then he did not play the entire thing. Same for Tim LoCastro. So it could have been one of them. But I don't know. I don't want to, like, assume anything and, like, defame anyone, you know? Even though I'm the one who wrote this question.
We could just throw out every single name on the roster. So that, you know, it's kind of an equal opportunity to faming.
Yeah, that works. So, Clayton Kershaw.
Looking at the Dodgers roster, I think it was... Actually, I'm probably just going to go with that. It was either definitely Chase Utley or definitely not Chase Utley.
Those are the two options. So, yes. You really cornered this one, Jen.
There is no way he can sue me for defamation because I gave the two options.
Yeah. So. I'm looking at he would have been on the field, I guess, when the game ended. So I wanted it to be true. I wanted it to be Chase Utley because it seems like it would have been, I don't know. Not, I didn't want to say on brand, but like, I don't know. It would have been like, just imagine, like, you know, being like, oh, we just did this great thing. And Chase Utley being like, oh, really? That's nice. You know?
I can totally, totally see that happening. And it's just very Chase Utley.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. It could also be like Pedro Baez because he's just so slow that, you know, like maybe it's not just in terms of his pitching, it's just his overall demeanor and approach to life. So yeah. It just takes a while.
Yeah, he, like, it can take a while to process things sometimes. Like, oh, that's what happens?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I'm still, like, several minutes behind everybody.
Exactly. And he's like, oh,
that's just that just reminds me of the season that I somehow completely missed that Zach Greinke was traded to the Angels. And then when he signed with the Dodgers, I was like, wait, he was with the Angels? So that did happen to me, and I am very slow with some things sometimes, but I also don't know how, as someone who watched a game every day that year, that I missed Zach Greinke was with the Angels. So,
and because it was the Angels and it was 2012. Actually, no, the Angels were good in 2012. What am I talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's weird. Yeah, what's going on with that, Jen?
I don't know. I really don't understand myself. So So heading over to the AL East this past week, this past Wednesday, news broke that the Red Sox's top pitching prospect, Jason Groom, will require Tommy John surgery. Groom, who is 19, was a first-round draft pick in 2016 with a projected major league arrival date of 2020, though that's obviously going to be delayed now. Not only is Mary our resident Canadian, she's also a resident Red Sox fan. So, Mary, what does this mean for the Red Sox?
I mean, it's not great. They don't have a super deep talent pool in the minors because this is a Dave Dombrowski team, and that's always the case. So I think that the organization was kind of banking a lot on Groom, especially because I think it's Price and Pomeranz can opt out after this season, and then I think Sale and Porcello are done the next season or something like that. So that's four of our five starters could potentially be off of the team by the start of the 2020 season. So I think that they were kind of putting a lot of hopes on Groom to be able to be involved in the next phase of this organization. And they don't really have. He's obviously the number one ranking prospect in the organization. And beyond him, they don't really have a lot of pitching depth. So they have Tanner Houck, who is, I think, projected to be a mid-rotation starter. But he's only pitched, I think 20 to 25 innings or so of pro ball. So he is also still a long way away. As is the next high-ranked starter, Brian Matta. He's only 18 years old. And he's also projected to kind of be a middle of the rotation guy. So it was really essentially all up to Groom. Of course, this doesn't mean that his career is, going to be over or whatever. It's obviously no guarantee that he will come back and be as effective post-surgery. But, and obviously it will delay him by, probably 2 years at this point. But he does have such great quote unquote stuff. I, hate that term, but I'm going to use it anyway. That I think he should be able to make, a comeback from his injury. And so I think that if he doesn't get traded, probably 2022 is when the team can kind of now bank on him making it to the majors.
Would you be interested in a slightly used Jeff Samardzija?
No. No, I would not. I mean,
please take him away. Please take him away.
No, thank you. Maybe the NFL will trade for him. And also, another thing is, so his name is Jason, but a lot of people call him Jay, so I don't know if that's his preference to go by Jay or if he still prefers Jason because different places use Jay, different places use Jason. So that's another kind of confusing thing that I'm still working my way through, and I just want him to pick one.
I think he's been going by Jay Groom lately just because that's also what it says on his MILB page.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably the safe bet, but I also know that because he was drafted as Jason Groom, people keep calling him Jason Groom, and because I have not heard anything on him since he was drafted, I keep thinking that he's still Jason Groom, but then Googling it was like, oh, he goes by Jay.
And his middle name is also Jay, so I'm just waiting for him to turn that into
Jason Groom.
I mean, there's still people out there who will refer to Giancarlo Stanton as Mike, so I think if you get drafted under a certain name, there are some people who may never adjust to that. So, he should have, if he wanted to be Jay, he should have decided that sooner. Come on.
Exactly. Right at birth. Why do they even go with Jason?
Yes. You only get to have one name
yeah.
in your life.
So, Going back to another topic we kind of touched upon last week, and also somehow involving the NFL, we talked last week about Ichiro Suzuki transitioning from playing to kind of a behind-the-scenes front office role with the Mariners, but, well, Ichiro's back in the news this week because, as it turns out, he doesn't know who Tom Brady is. The story, as reported by Peter Gammons at The Athletic, is that Brady texted Ichiro to see if they could meet so Brady could study Ichiro's stretching system. Ichiro's response? Who the F is Tom Brady?
My dude.
I love that so much.
Where does this rank in the pantheon of classic Ichiro stories?
It's up there.
It is, yeah. I don't know if it surpasses his Cleveland quote about punching himself in the face if he ever lived there. I think that's probably my all-time favorite Ichiro quote. But this might be second to that.
Yeah, it's great because not only is it character revealing that, yeah, this is a guy who's obviously so focused on what he's doing that he doesn't, you know, pay attention to things like football, you know, just because he supposedly has to, or because it's like such a thing in American culture. But it also insults Tom Brady. And that is always entertaining.
So
it's just so great that he's like, not only does he not care or know about football, he also just insulted Tom Brady, and it's so great. And I'm sorry to cut you off.
I was just going to ask, how do we think that Brady got Ichiro's number?
He said that he got it from A-Rod.
Okay.
Yeah, which I feel like that just adds like a layer of smarminess to it. And that's maybe not fair because, like, you know, they're pro athletes. Like, they're going to associate. Like, that's just, you know, I should judge them and be like, oh, I got your number from A-Rod, but it still kind of felt like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna like bust on in, like, you know, he's just so used to like people knowing who he is that like I don't fault him too much for just assuming Ichiro would be aware of who he was, but like I don't know, it's like very, it's fun to see someone who you know is like used to like things being like just so great for them for so long kind of getting knocked down a peg. And again, this is maybe is being a little overly harsh on Tom Brady, but you know what?
Whatever.
He can deal with it. He's yeah. A big boy.
He can go cry into his stacks of money.
Yes, with his model wife. Oh, his life is so hard because Ichiro doesn't know who he is. Although to be fair, that would probably traumatize me. Like
I'd be like, but my life is over, you know?
Not that Ichiro should know who we are, but like if Ichiro like made me feel like
Ichiro listens bad. To this podcast.
Like, oh my god. It'd be really funny if Ichiro knew who we are, but not who Tom Brady is.
That's just like that's gonna be my new mission. Like I'm gonna make Ichiro figure out who I am. Just so I can be like I'm more famous than Tom Brady.
I think one of the things that I'm also just, like, wondering about is how a Boston superstar asks a New York superstar.
Oh, I know. It's going to make Boston.
For a number.
I haven't seen any of the reactions to that, but I imagine that there are a lot of angry Boston fans at the moment.
I was just thinking, like, how hasn't Boston burned down from that?
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure they're just trying to, like, hold it in, but
I feel like that's the subtext story. It's like, wait, this is going to burn down Boston. Why hasn't it yet?
Maybe that was A-Rod's plan. So he was like, yeah, I'll give you, maybe Brady, like, didn't even ask him, actually, and it was just, like, A-Rod just kind of, like, texted him out of the blue and was like, hey, like, I'll turn this into a story. Like, here's Ichiro's number. Good luck.
A-Rod's secret plan. To burn down Boston, or at least Boston media, yeah. Which I would actually be for A-Rod burning down Boston media. That would be interesting.
I mean, I
think and also funny.
It's fair game for him. They certainly did not treat him kindly during his time with the Yankees.
Well, to be fair, he was a Yankees
player. Well, yes, he was. I do remember that.
That was the thing that happened.
Yeah.
Well, also, to be fair, he was a Mariners player at one point. And Rangers.
And then almost Red Sox, and the league was like, how about no?
So, it's been a busy week in the MLB. And also this week, MLB began cracking down on player cleat violations. The rule in the CBA stipulates that players must wear cleats on which their team's predominant colors make up 51% of the shoe. Ben Zobrist posted a very impassioned rant on Instagram stating, "Dear MLB, I still like you, but this is ridiculous. For the past 2 years, I've worn black spikes exclusively at Wrigley Field for day games to pay homage to our history of our great game. And now I'm being told I will be fined and disciplined if I continue to wear them. When I was a kid, I was inspired by highlights of the greats such as Ernie Banks and Stan Musial in the 1950s and 60s and was captured by the old uniforms and all-black cleats with flaps. New Balance Baseball made a kid's dream come true by making some all-black spikes with a special tongue as well as the Benny the Jet, PF Flyers cleats. I'm curious as to why MLB is spending time and money enforcing this now when they haven't done it previously in the last year and beyond. I have heard nothing but compliments from fans that they enjoy the, quote, old school look. Maybe there is some kid out there that will be inspired to look more into the history of the game by the, quote, flexibility that I prefer in the color of my shoes. Sincerely, Ben Zobrist." And Mike Clevenger also tweeted a photo of the letter he received from MLB stating, "Make baseball fun again, they said. It would be fun, they said." MLB released a statement to ESPN saying, "We have shoe regulations that were negotiated with the union in the last round of bargaining. If players have complaints about the regulations, they should contact their union, which negotiated them. We have informed the union that we are prepared to negotiate rules providing players with more flexibility, and that issue is currently being discussed as part of a larger discussion about apparel and equipment." Is this rule something MLB should enforce, or is there a better way to go about things?
Go ahead. No. All right, let's start over. I think this is such an inconsequential thing. You know, it's weird to me that this is a thing to get hung up on because it's shoes, you know? I think what's important here is that they're functional and that they allow players to play the game in a way that's safe for them. And to be this focused on things like if it's 51% of the team's colors, which like we were talking about this before we were recording, it's like, how do you figure that out? Do you like, you know, measure the shoe and like measure the exact amount of space each color takes up? Like that seems like you could easily like get into arguments over that alone. And obviously if someone's wearing black cleats, like if it's not, you know, like the White Sox, like for most players, you know, that obviously wouldn't qualify, but like nonetheless, it just seems like that's so neutral that it just seems like a very odd thing to be causing a stir. And it just feels like it's a very easy way to let players be expressive. And, you know, maybe it is something that needs to be renegotiated with the CBA because it's obviously something that players care about. But like I said, it just seems of all things to get hung up on, like this seems like a kind of silly thing.
Yeah, it just seems to be dragging a Major League Baseball into NFL territory, which is something that Major League Baseball should be wary about because people have been complaining for years about how strict the NFL is when it comes to things like this. So I think it's just something that is going to enrage the players, and I think especially in blaming the MLBPA for it is going to make the players more critical of the MLBPA and of the type of representation it has for them. And I think that this is something that might backfire for Major League Baseball in terms of players being more aware of the fact that they need a stronger union.
So, this is This is going to showcase why everyone told me I should have gone to law school, but I would have just one. I think it's, I agree with Ben Zobrist that this is ridiculous, and I don't think it's something that should be enforced if it hasn't been enforced before. And it's like, why are they suddenly trying to enforce it now? Like, what's the purpose? Why are they trying to find players for these things? And it's like, you didn't find them before. Two, my ideal way to go about things, just to kind of be that person, is if a formal complaint was lodged, and with Zobrist saying that, looking more into the history of the game and team's predominant colors, and since he plays for the Cubs, he could have said, "Oh, well, I'm paying homage to, history, but also in 1907, when the Cubs won their first ever World Series, their primary color was black." That's what I would have done. I would have been like, "Is there anything that says that it has to be current predominant colors?" And that is why people say I should have gone to law school, but I also don't want to go to law school.
Yeah,
So,
don't go.
Ben Zobrist, if you're out there listening, which I highly doubt, you could try using that defense, paying homage to not only Ernie Banks and Stan Musial, but also the Cubs' first ever World Series in 1907, where they had a black Tuscan C on their hats.
I like this world that we've conjured up where Ichiro Suzuki and Ben Zobrist listen to this podcast.
I mean, like, we don't know who listens, so.
We don't. We,
No.
you know, the listener statistics, it's how,
It
yeah.
doesn't say who is
Yeah.
who.
If we see like 45-year-old male, I don't know, like we can just assume, oh, that's Ichiro. Like, okay, cool.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I'm assuming we'll never find out that he doesn't listen to the podcast, so. I
There
think
you
it's a fair
go.
assumption.
You can't prove a negative.
And if we do find out that he doesn't listen to the podcast, that will make him aware of the podcast. And so he'll still know about us, either way.
Mission accomplished.
Take that, Tom Brady.
I suddenly feel like we're in that John Mulaney bit about lawyers.
I wish my life was a John Mulaney bit, although not all of them. Like, just mostly just the salt and pepper diner.
Yes. Yep. I'm so tempted to do that if I'm ever in a diner with a jukebox.
I was once at, this is way off the topic of baseball. I was once at a diner where someone, or it was a bar, I guess, someone put in a bunch of plays of The Boys Are Back in Town, and it just like wouldn't play them after like I think it didn't even like play it the second time. So I think he just lost his money. So maybe the jukebox people have gotten wise to this scheme.
Yeah.
And there was also that article in Vice about how this guy played it like 47 times. The boys are back in town.
Yeah,
Played it 47
I think the
times.
person that I was with was like trying to recreate that unsuccessfully.
Now I'm also thinking, like, what if you go to a place near a ballpark and you just play John Fogerty's center field repeatedly on an off day and make people think that there's a game? And now I've tied it back to
Good
baseball.
work.
Now for our final topic of the week. The Diamondbacks received permission from Maricopa County to leave Chase Field in downtown Phoenix and will possibly be moving to tribal land in Scottsdale near their spring training facility. The land is part of the Salt River Pima Maricopa Reservation, and Salt River Fields at Talking Stick is already on tribal land. Part of the deal that allows the D-backs out of the lease early includes team taking over maintenance of Chase Field. Per Bob Nightingale, who broke the story on in USA Today, is like, under the deal, the team will take control of stadium maintenance and will be allowed to spend $35 million in repair money on a new scoreboard, air conditioning equipment, and other items that were previously in dispute. The team could also receive up to $20 million from the county at the end of the contract as reimbursement for repairs. The team will also be taking over booking concerts and events from Scottsdale-based events manager Select Artist Associates, and any net revenue will be dedicated to the repairs. In return, the county will be released from any obligation to pay for further repairs and will maintain ownership of the land in downtown Phoenix, which county leaders said could be redeveloped if the team leaves. Chase Field is structurally unsound, and Maricopa County won't put in the money into repairs, which has gotten worse over the years. As someone who has been to Chase Field a lot over the last year, I have seen some of it being very visible in the structure, and it's kind of concerning. And like, there's equipment breakdowns, and in the NL wildcard game, the escalator going down from the upper levels back down to the concourse broke with people on it. And if that's something that happens in the middle of a postseason, you know, a playoff game, like, that's very concerning. But another thing is, who would be paying for the stadium if and when they move? That would be one of the bigger issues regarding it, because I know, you know, with Atlanta, there's been a lot of discussion about how, is it SunTrust Park?
Yeah.
Was funded, and then also the ballpark in Arlington, because the Rangers are planning to move out of, well, the ballpark in Arlington, or is it Globe Life? I don't know. I don't know current stadium names anymore, for a new stadium, and that is also public funding. But it would be interesting, because there's been many rumors in the Phoenix area, and especially in Scottsdale, that the Salt River Pima Maricopa tribe has been lobbying to get a sports arena that's not just a spring training facility on their land and negotiating for it. And I just keep wondering where the funding is going to be coming, especially since publicly funded ballparks have gone out of fashion with a lot of people lately.
Just because they're out of fashion doesn't mean that they don't happen, though.
True. Very true. There will be a lot of opposition at the very least. And I will say that I have a lot of feelings about publicly funded ballparks, because I once wrote a paper in a public sector economics class about public funding of stadiums primarily used by private entities, and presented paper with a concluding slide of Billy the Marlin next to a fish tank saying, "Go fish."
How could we forget the Marlins?
You need to get the Marlins in every podcast.
Oh, Jeffrey Loria. So that's something we will probably keep an eye on, as it is pertinent to baseball, and also what happens to Chase Field, and if they decide to move or just try to re-engineer Chase Field, because it's, if you look closely at like the pillars as you enter Chase Field, like, there's cracks in places that shouldn't be cracking. And it gets frightening sometimes if you're just, like, kind of waiting and then you notice that and you're like, oh, so is this why they're saying that it's structurally unsound? It's scary.
And it's not even that old, right?
Yeah.
No, it was built in the late 90s. It's, like, 20
years old. Yeah, it's, like, as old as the team, and they're in their 20th season.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, something that was built in a little more than 20 years ago should not be having this much structural foundational issues.
Yeah, it's wild to me that, you know, we have ballparks that are over 100 years old, and yet here we have teams that can't stay in a ballpark for like 25 years. Like, it's just, I don't know, there's some cognitive dissonance going on with that.
And I feel like it's one thing with the Braves situation where it's like, oh, we just want to go to a area where we know we'll draw more fans. Like, that feels like a useless way just to move into a new stadium. But this one's more like, oh, this stadium's literally falling apart and no one's paying for repairs. And I'm just like, I get that Maricopa County does not want to pay for this, but also, why wasn't it built correctly in the first place?
Yeah, that and seems like something that should be getting more attention than that should be, like, someone, if not multiple groups, should be being held responsible.
Yeah, especially since, you know, it's a stadium that holds tens of thousands of people.
Yeah, it's not like Arizona goes through extreme weather situations where...
Well...
I mean, yeah, but it's not like...
Yeah, yeah, extreme heat versus like extreme, like, yeah, it's very different.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like the only thing that they have to worry about is going from like 125 in the summer to like 75 in the winter, and that's not even too extreme. So it's like, you know what the weather patterns are like in downtown Phoenix. Why didn't someone account for that? Why didn't someone account for, I don't know, building materials and just the architecture of it all? And I feel like it's not discussed a lot that Chase Field has these issues. It's just like, oh, the county won't pay for repairs. And it's like, but why wasn't it built right in the first place? And that's just kind of worrisome, especially if it's like, if they move to a new stadium, will the stadium be built correctly? Yeah, it's just very, very, very odd. But this is also an area of baseball that I have a weird interest in because I was an economics student and took quite an interest in publicly funded stadiums. And I have many thoughts about it. So there is that. I could go, I once spent 2 hours talking about publicly funded stadiums, so I'm just going to end it right there. So thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times audio. You can find the Hardball Times at fangraphs.com/THT and on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at Jen McRamos. You can find Sarah at SarahWexler32. You can find Mary at Miriam Craig. And you can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times audio on fangraphs.com/THT/THT-audio. And iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.